This call is being recorded.
Hi, this is Alisa. Let me just give you a quick heads up about how we'll keep roll so we can know who is participating and who's not for the practice leaders mostly. There are people that will not be able to participate live. We understand that, so we record it and they can listen to it later. We do ask that you encourage them to listen right away after the call would have occurred so that they're using the task for the entire month. Our intention is to do it early so they have the whole month to work on the goals rather than doing it 2 days before the next call and then they're a month behind. I will also send out to each of the practice leaders a recap of who I think participated from their specific practice so that they can let me know if somebody else participated some other way that didn't show up on this Uber conference platform.
Elise, can I access, is there a webinar version of this or is it just conference call?
You can look at the slides on the www.uberconference.com/AAP Utah. That was in the email. You can connect there with both what you can see on the, just, it's not a live like people. It will be slides if applicable, or you can call in if you can't hear on that platform. And if that is the case, then call me sometime in the next month and let's troubleshoot your computer to make sure all the settings are correct so that you can both see and hear through Uber Conference. That was the intention of troubleshooting. The advantage to using everything in Uber Conference is A, that you're seeing what the presenters are putting up on the screen. And then also you have a way to ask questions. So just by way of housekeeping here, on the right-hand side, there are 5 little icons. The middle one is a text box with little dots in it. And if you press that, you can see that's the way you can access the chat. If you wanted to ask a question during anybody's presentation, then you could ask it there. And if it's not appropriate to ask it yourself or to give feedback like we can't hear or something like that. So, okay.
Got it.
Okay. So just in terms of how the conference calls are going to go, I want to give you a little bit of information. We'll always use the Uber Conference platform. The calls will be recorded. And like I mentioned in the kickoff, they are compliant with HIPAA, but I do need to have one caveat there. And that is that any patient information that is discussed during the live conference is compliant. However, of course, it doesn't stand for the recorded version. So if any personal information or relevant information needs to be edited out for the recorded version, I will do that after the initial live conference. Each time when you join the conference, make sure you announce yourself. I do take roles so that I can see who's here. We have a backup for that, which is a link to a Google Doc where you sign in and just say that you participated. You do that whether you're participating live or if you listen to the recorded version after. And then, of course, to avoid the noise from what's going on in your background, if you will mute your microphone either through the Uber Conference platform or through your own mute on a telephone, that will help keep reverberation from everybody. Just a couple of things for you to think about for this presentation. Wanted to recap what we were doing for February. February was where we would gather baseline data and really an exercise for you to recognize what you're currently doing in your practice. So what are the processes that you have? How is your staff involved or not? And where could your processes be improved during the course of the project? And Dr. Cosgrove will talk about that in more in depth later on. Just in terms of the role of the practice leader, they will help coordinate the goals for both what we're learning each conference call, but also helping you to enact that in your personal practices. They will also enter data into KEDA. So in most cases, the practice leader will enter 10 charts per physician or participant per month. There will be some practices that don't see 10 patients a month that are the 11 to 12 year old age range, and that's completely fine. Just do the very best that you have access to, and we'll close the charts in the Ketem system manually in the event that there aren't 10 and you can close it on your own. The other part that the practice leader helps to do is make sure that each of the practices is having a monthly huddle of some sort where you're involving your staff and having them listen to whatever is the pertinent part for that month, the survivor story, or some, you know, it may evolve and be different from month to month. So, and then the last bit is that each month a survey through a SurveyMonkey platform will come through, and that needs to be completed each month. So there's just a few things. And then, of course, helping me to make sure the practices are on the same page and everybody's participated, kind of just basics. So if you haven't already, make sure that you have given me your practice leader information. So that would be a name and a contact via email and phone. All of the links and data will come to you each month in an email. I do email several times a month to keep you on track. I'll reach out if you're falling behind. Falling behind would look like that we have to have 5 consecutive months of data collection. So falling behind would mean that you have missed 1 month, or if you miss more than 1 month, then we're in trouble for the eligibility for the MOC credit. So let's just talk to each other to get you squared away, and I will email regularly so you know what's expected and when things are due. We are going to go ahead and turn the time over to Diane Liu. She's going to talk about PDSA cycles. And by the way, each of you should have received an email yesterday that has the document that she wanted you to have access to that she'll be discussing in her presentation. So if you didn't, let me know, and I'll actually just send it with the recap. Go ahead, Diane.
Great, thank you. And I just wanted to tell everyone, welcome. My name is Diane Liu, and I'm the director of the Utah Pediatric Partnership to Improve Healthcare Quality. And I'll just take a moment to, first of all, let you know that I'm thrilled to be able to be part of this effort. And so I thank Chuck Pruitt and Bill Cosgrove, and then also Elisa Stoddard for getting me involved. Bill, because we've been working on this before, and Chuck Pruitt, because he's been such a fantastic AAP president and really receptive to some of the ideas I think that community pediatricians have. In terms of the AAP HPV effort, I believe that you had a kickoff probably a few weeks ago, and I wasn't able to attend that.
We did your recorded version, yes. And
okay, so that's important for me to know for all of you new clinicians, that that information last year may have been a little, to some degree, relevant to the cohort then, and there's some things that this year and this cohort I would be more than happy to adjust and be available to you to answer questions through this effort. You can see at the bottom of your screen in the right-hand corner a little screen sign. I would encourage you to click on that. That is where Elisa is presenting or sharing the PowerPoint slides. So take a minute and go ahead and pull that up. Great. So Elisa, I'll just ask you to scroll through the slides as I talk. Is that okay?
Yep, that's great.
Okay, we have less than 10 slides. It'll be very brief this morning, but I was asked to basically give a short primer on the PDSA cycle. And I know it's one of those things where you say, how much can we talk about with the PDSA cycle? But I, you know, interestingly enough, have a lot to share. So first of all, developing changes that are new, by definition, requires a creative effort. And that is why I placed on here the art of improvement as part of the title. I think that that's one of those unique opportunities that we have as clinicians to innovate. We hear that word all the time, it loses meaning, but in healthcare delivery, the opportunity for us to make changes, and those changes are new to us, requires an effort that's creative. So think of back in the day when you decided to enter medicine and the part of the art of medicine and what does it mean to practice medicine. This is taking an opportunity to highlight that area. Studying those changes and their resulting impact, beneficial or not beneficial, forces us to consider the science of improvement, which is the traditional way in which we look at improvement. It's improvement science, implementation science, that there's hypothesis testing going on. But that's why I think the topic and the primer for a PDSA cycle is really interesting and important, and I hope that you will take this message today and bring it back to your organization. So for this primer, the most important thing is many people are familiar with the term PDSA cycle. There's a number of you in this cohort today that have you've actually joined previous UPIC learning communities when we've improved around different conditions like childhood adverse experiences or asthma. So in that, those kind of learning collaboratives, which are very common across the country, we oftentimes apply the model for improvement, which includes PDSA cycles. We don't really fully use it, I think, the way that's intended, because we're so busy with so many balls juggling, not just as clinicians, but when we're trying to improve. So to me, this is probably the most vital part that we gloss over or rush through in any QI effort. So I encourage you to refine this skill, take the opportunity with this collaborative or this learning community for HPV to refine the skill within your own team and throughout your organization. And though the PDSA cycle is meant to promote rapid cycle testing, sometimes the cycle actually takes longer than we anticipated. And so, again, I think a lot of practice is actually important. Okay, can you please advance to the next slide? Principles of improvement. So I actually want to make sure that you know the source of these principles, because I think that of all of the things that I've studied, the Improvement Guide by Langley and Provost provides some foundational pillars about why we're even experiencing all this transformation in healthcare in the first place. So the principles of improvement include knowing why you need to improve. I think everyone understands that when physicians are being asked to change, they have to understand why. Having a feedback mechanism to tell you if the improvement is happening. That's one of the benefits of measuring, so you can actually determine if improvement is happening. And then the next two I highlighted in red, because this is what the PDSA cycle really focuses on. Developing an effective change. So the keyword is effective there, that will result in improvement. And testing a change before you actually implement it. And then finally, knowing when and how to implement a change. Okay, if you could advance to the next slide. Slide, science of improvement. In this model for improvement, which is the basic structural methodology that a lot of healthcare organizations use. So I should backtrack and just make sure that you know that UPIC has oftentimes used that structure, the model for improvement. Other organizations might use Lean and Six Sigma, and there's overlap in terms of its principles with the model for improvement. But in terms of the model for improvement, the learner, so that's all of us, we are asked a specific set of questions. And in one of those questions includes, what changes can we make that will result in an improvement? And so what we're doing here is making predictions. So we get to pull out our basic science hat of hypothesis testing, and that's what you're doing with your teams. You're basically, you have a lab right now, and you're going to make predictions. Once you select a change idea, and selecting one can be involved, heavily involved. For HPV, it might not be as dramatic as another effort you might be making within your practice. But once you select the actual change idea, it's time to turn that idea into action and connect that action to learning. And so I have just a little cartoon there that I think is important, that you're driving learning, and in turn, your learning is driving your new ideas. And you're learning through that cycle. And that's when we enter the PDSA cycle. You go ahead and advance to the next slide. So the fourth slide is entitled, PDSA is shorthand for basically testing a change. So many of you have seen this plan. You develop a plan to test the actual change. That's where we don't actually take a moment and take the time sometimes in our healthcare improvement efforts. So make sure you make a plan, and I'll give you a tool. That's what Elisa referred to earlier, that will help you map out the plan if you have a very large organization and you have a lot of variation in the way in which your clinicians and their teams are practicing. Do, which means you actually have to carry out the test. And, you know, as simple as that sounds, sometimes we just kind of go back to our everyday workflow, and we can force ourselves to do something new. And that's something really important to follow back up with your team about. You want to study, which means you're observing and learning from the consequences of carrying out that test. And obviously, act, take action. Once you've done the study, determine what modifications should be made. So this source of the PDSA and the information there can be found on IHI.org, which I think is a great resource for practicing clinicians. Okay, you can advance to the fifth slide. This is a tool that will be emailed to you if you haven't received it yet by Elisa, and it's entitled the PDSA Cycle Form with a Checklist Format. And it's a pretty involved form, but I think that if you want to start collecting materials, if your teams want to draw on certain resources, it's a nice form to have because it's comprehensive. And it's from the improvement guide. Okay, this number six slide. This is an example of a PDSA worksheet. So here's a different worksheet. It's shorter than the one that was in the previous slide that you can access. It's open access at or IHI.org. And I highlighted in yellow the things that I populated when I was thinking about HPV improvement in our organization at University Pediatrics. And in red, I wrote the narrative about what was going on in terms of our PDSA cycle test. So that is just a sample for you in case you want to give your MA, your nursing staff, something very specific to work on with you. So the next slide, number seven, is you may have heard that all improvement occurs due to a change, that not all changes lead to an improvement. Well, that's what we're basically saying here, that improvement is an outcome, or effective improvement is an outcome of the application of knowledge. And that knowledge has to be, when I put appropriate, I mean that it's knowledge that you know matches what you're going to do in terms of the improvement. So we can learn a lot of things, and if we're not actually applying the appropriate knowledge, then obviously we won't actually see the improvement. And remember that knowledge is gained sequentially. The eighth slide, if you scroll to the next slide, is an image from the improvement guide that I felt was very informative for you as clinicians to illustrate the model for improvement. So remember, whenever you're working with your teams on any improvement effort, you're going to ask them, what are we trying to accomplish? Ask yourself that question. How will we know that a change is an improvement, and what changes can we make that will result in an improvement? And the idea is that as you're developing plans and testing your changes and learning from them, sequentially you're going to build knowledge. And if you can do these rapidly, then you're going to learn faster. And ultimately, you'll be able to implement ideas that will, I think, achieve breakthrough for you and your organization in terms of transformation of care. So the last slide is contact information. And I just want to take a moment to let you know that I joined UPIC as a co-director in late 2014 with Chuck Nolan, and I've since become the director as of January 2017 last year. We had a really successful asthma collaborative. We're going to present the findings at a conference in Toronto, and we're going to have another asthma collaborative coming up. And I think the great thing about partnering with UPIC, with the AAP, is that there's always an opportunity for you as a clinician to be connected to a community of learners and receive MOC. So thank you for your time today.
Very good. Thank you, Diane. We are going to go ahead and turn the time over to Dr. Deanna Kapka from the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and she's going to be a resource for us through the program.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. A little bit about me. I'm coming at this from the behavioral scientist and health services researcher perspective. I've been working in HPV vaccination research for about 10 years. And I am a population scientist at Huntsman Cancer Institute. And I'm really excited. I've been working in the Mountain West for about five, six years. But this is the first time that we have participants on a project from Alaska. So I'm hoping we can learn more about what you're doing in Alaska and how issues are similar there or different. I think it'd be great to expand our knowledge about factors that are affecting the entire Mountain West region of the United States, because that's been most of my focus. So are my slides up? So a little bit about me. I am also on faculty in the College of Nursing. So I teach nurses who are getting their PhD or their doctorate of nursing practice. And I lead a number of studies at Huntsman Cancer Institute that are looking at factors related to HPV vaccination using large data sets such as vaccine immunization registry data or national surveys. The number one way that we learn about vaccine status of states or even of subregions is using the NIST data, which CDC collects through the National Center for Health Statistics. So I lead quite a few studies using those data to understand what's happening at the small contextual level or the small community level around HPV vaccination in the United States. And I also play an active role in HPV education and policy as a member of the American Cancer Society HPV Vaccination Roundtable. And I'm the chair-elect for coalitions and state-level roundtables who are doing work in HPV. And so these resources can all help you in the fact that my team, Laura Martel, who you'll hear a lot about too, she works with me, we have a lot of resources that can connect you with the latest and greatest and hottest information around how to improve HPV vaccination in your clinic environment that is being pushed out by the National Cancer Roundtable and is supported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Cancer Institute. So we will share resources with you around those web-based, evidence-based suggestions for your practice that I hope will find helpful. And I'm also hoping that you'll be interested in joining our coalition. About 4 years ago, I think in 2014, Hudson Cancer Institute was one of 18 cancer centers in the United States to receive a grant from the National Cancer Institute to do work in HPV vaccination education and building partnerships to develop interventions to improve HPV vaccination rates in our region. And since then, there's been 12 more grantees. So now there's been 30 grantees out of all 69 cancer centers that are funded by NCI who are now doing work to some degree in HPV vaccination. Our first task is to understand, it's called an environmental scan, what's going on in our region. And so my region isn't just Utah, but it started off including Idaho and Nevada, and now it spans the whole Mountain West region. And the reason why we came together is we were noticing a lot of similarities in terms of vaccination uptake, more conservative values, smaller towns, and rural factors that could relate to vaccination. And so for those of you who are in smaller practices, I'd love to learn more about different barriers that you may have and those of you who are in larger practices. So we got this grant and we have been doing work with our coalition since 2014 to expand access to resource and education about how to improve HPV vaccination in your region and how we can build partnerships. And we have members from all across disciplines. So the goal of this coalition is not to have a research focus, but to focus with where the cancer centers are building partnerships with health departments and AAP chapters, just like this one. And the most important component of our coalition, which is going to contribute to this hub and spoke project, is our cancer survivor or our HPV advocate program. So Dr. Cosgrove has asked us to, we have a team of HPV advocates, which are women, and we're still looking for men who have been affected by HPV cancers in the Mountain West, who will share their stories with you on these monthly calls. So if you can move to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about vaccination in our region. Okay, so at the time when we got this award to build this coalition in the Mountain West, you can see that Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, we are this white black hole in the western region of the United States. We're having some of the lowest rates of HPV vaccination in the country. We're doing a little bit better. These are 2015 data. We now have 2016 data, and by this summer, we'll have 2017 data. And then if you move to the next slide, so this is first dose of HPV vaccination among girls. And then if we look at first dose of HPV vaccination among boys, we still have some states like Wyoming in lowest quintile of the country, and then Nevada, Idaho, Utah, also way below the average for the United States. And I could say even our current data are a little bit worse for boys. We're seeing a huge disparity between patients' receipt of the HPV vaccine by gender. And so we're hoping that promoting the message to unify and promote this vaccine with a strong HPV vaccination recommendation for boys and girls equally will help improve that disparity in the future. Another thing I'd like to comment is in the entire United States, I think we have, I think about 50% of kids getting the HPV vaccine. And in Utah, we have less than half of our kids getting the vaccine. So we've got quite a ways to go to make it the new norm in the Mountain West. It is a new norm in the United States, but it's not quite the new norm in the US. And when you look at factors like completion of the series, we're down to 20 and 30% of our kids completing the series. And most of you may know it's a 2-dose series now for kids under 15 and a 3-dose series for kids 15 and older. Okay, keep going. So the goal of our advocate program that I'm going to be working with Alisa and AAP, is to help pediatricians. We know as pediatric primary care providers, you're not likely to ever encounter an HPV-related cancer. HPV cancers affect men and women later in life. You know, women, it can be up to their 30s, 40s, are mean averages of diagnosis with cervical cancer. Men who are diagnosed with HPV oral pharyngeal cancer or anal penile cancer, it may not be into their 50s or even 60s. So as a pediatrician, you're very unlikely to encounter an HPV-related cancer in your practice. You may encounter genital warts, which we do have 500,000 cases of genital warts in the United States each year. So our goal with the Advocate Program is to give you more of a personal perspective on what having an HPV cancer or losing a loved one due to an HPV cancer or experiencing HPV-related cancer symptoms and treatments and trauma can do to a family and how it affects real people living here in Utah and in the Mountain West. So our advocates are brave women who have partnered with our coalition to share their story on these calls, but they also share their stories at meetings and to give a little bit of experience about what it's been like for them to be diagnosed with a cancer that is now completely preventable. Almost all cervical cancers are caused by HPV, but between the vaccine and ongoing Pap tests, we should be seeing the elimination of cervical cancer in the next 30 years. And that's really exciting news. But that's not going to happen without that strong physician recommendation and the strong parent enthusiasm to receive the vaccine. So our HPV advocates are individuals who have been diagnosed with an HPV-related cancer or precancer or have been impacted by a family member or a loved one who had an HPV-related cancer. Okay, the next slide. If you would like us to have an HPV advocate, do a Skype call or a webinar call with your practice team, we can organize that. We can also help you connect with our coalition and other resources with our coalition. And again, you'll learn more about the advocate experiences on these calls. Okay, next one. And for those of you in the Salt Lake region or within a couple hours of Salt Lake City, we can even arrange for in-person meetings. And we're still working on building our advocate network in the nearby states. We do have a few, but we haven't quite, it's not as solid as we'd like it to be at this point. So these are some of the resources that we'll provide to you during your time in this quality improvement project. And we can also help you share these stories with your teams if you think it would be helpful too. All right, next slide. And so we're hoping that you'll join our coalition and you'll receive an email from Laura Martel. And what if you do join our coalition, you don't have to participate actively. You could just take advantage of being on our listserv, which will give you a newsletter each month. It'll keep you up to date on our priority areas of research and our priorities of HPV cancer education in the region. It'll also keep you informed on what we're working on in terms of recruiting clinics for future studies in years to come that we're looking for funding for from the National Cancer Institute. And we're always happy to partner with ideas for manuscript presentation or for public health education through conferences about how this has been going, how your work in this quality improvement project is helping your practice and what you've learned and, you know, just how we can all work together to improve HPV recognition in our region. Okay, next slide. So these are videos that the American Cancer Society HPV Vaccination Roundtable has put together. There's a series of 12 survivor videos, or maybe even more at this point, that you can share, you can watch yourself and you can share with your clinic teams that, you know, give the perspective of a patient enduring HPV cancer diagnosis, treatment, even loss. And they also share the perspective of physicians, of oncologists who've treated these patients and the role that these oncologists have taken on, especially gynecological oncologists, and truly advocating for the HPV vaccine to pediatricians, to other primary care providers in the United States, to try and prevent those cancers that they see in their practice with what you can do in your practice for 11 and 12-year-olds. Next slide, please. So thank you so much. We're here to help you. And so these slides are from last year, but my kids are a little bit bigger this year. Actually, my son just turned 9 a few weeks ago, and I have the best idea for a present for him. I'm going to give him the gift of cancer prevention and get that HPV vaccine. So feel free to write with any questions, or you can put in the comment box or join us right now, and we will be in touch with you with ways to connect with our resources and for you to learn from our HPV advocates.
Thank you. I'm going to read a comment from one of our practice leaders, Callie Bell, from Utah Valley Pediatrics in Spanish Forks. She says, "This week I had a mom who would not allow her child to receive the HPV vaccine because a relative was injured with the vaccine and is a party to a lawsuit against HPV causing a connective tissue disease. Another who had a relative pass away after HPV, another who had neurologic issues. A real sense of distrust is alive and well with this vaccine, unlike any other vaccine. It is similar to MMR and autism, but worse. It's nice to hear the survivor stories, but when a mom sees her daughter is not going to be sexually active except after marriage, and yes, that still does happen, they do not want to put their child at risk. I need a good answer for that. I still encourage them to do it, but I had not heard of the lawsuit until this week. Is that really happening?" So I'll have Dr. Cosgrove talk about that. Are there any additional questions from those that are listening, or any questions for Dr. Koepka?
Yeah, this is Chuck Pruitt. I have a question for Deanna. At a recent AAP meeting, there was some data presented that indicated that for children under 13, girls under 13, I should say, that Utah was ahead of the national average. The percentages were 20% for Utah, 17% for the nation. For those girls under 13 receiving three HPV vaccine doses, this is 2014 data.
So that's the completion of this series. I was talking about receipt of the first dose, and I am most up to date with the 2016 data, where Utah is state number 34 for girls' first dose and state number 48 for boys' first dose.
Yeah, so, I found it interesting that according to these data, which was presented at this national meeting, that it looked as if we were doing better than the national average, which surprised me.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to, maybe it was just for completion. I'd have to see the data. If they were that old, it may have been the first, a long time ago, 2013, we may have been doing a little bit better than the average. But we've dropped down in comparison to the rest of the country. But that was only for girls. We've always had a really hard time with boys in Utah.
And I know as of right now, more accurate.
Yeah, as of right now, we only have 47% of our kids in Utah getting the first dose of the vaccine. That's both genders together. So there's new data that you can go to, and it's called TeenVaxU, and it's pretty amazing. You go to CDC, you search TeenVaxU HPV vaccination, and there's all, it's like a web app, so you can pick what data you're interested in. And I think the most important data for everyone on this call would be to look at your state and then look at the up-to-date statistics. So they'll do the up-to-date statistics based on kids' ages. So, you know, if the parent in the survey had a child who was 15, then they should have three doses. If the child was 14, two doses. So they're actually looking at it that way. So you can see what percent of children in your state are up-to-date with immunization. You can look at it by gender. So that's pretty helpful too. But I just put in a grant yesterday, and we know that almost all of our states in this region, especially the ones that are on this call, are below the national average for being up to date also for boys and
Thank
girls.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm happy to help anyone with the NIS team data.
Great. Yeah, I think I'll share your data and maybe your contact information with the presenters from this meeting. Thank you.
So I even have more up to date data than are on these slides right now. So I'm happy to share those too.
Are there any other questions?
But thanks for your questions.
Fabulous. Thank you, Dr. Koepka, for being a wealth of knowledge and a resource for everyone in the group as far as advocates go. We are going to turn the time over to Dr. Cosgrove now. It's just a reminder for everybody who's on, make sure you sign the sign-in so that I can actually put a phone number with a person to give you credit for participating for the month. All right, Dr. Cosgrove, go ahead.
Good morning, all. Thanks for joining our project. I think I'm going to talk about a few things, and then I'll try to get back to the question that was posed about when it gets thorny in the arguments and trying to convince a family to get their child immunized. As far as the project goes, what we asked you to do for this first month, for the month of February, is just to take a look at what it is you do. And that's always difficult because we just tend to mosey through the day and do things, and we get into habits and ruts. And it often is important just to stop and look at what we do, what our MA does, what the receptionist does, what do we actually say to parents, and then say, is that really what we are choosing? So quality improvement is simply stopping to take a look at what we do and deciding whether we want to change it or not. The second thing about when we make a change, I know my personal temptation is to change four things and then try it. And the trouble with that is if I succeed, I don't know which of the four to keep. If I fail, I don't know which of the four to abandon. So the hard discipline is to make one change and then take a little data. You can always come back to the second, third, and fourth change, but unless you are disciplined enough to make one small step, one small change, you're not going to know what you accomplished. So what I'm going to suggest is for March, I'm going to suggest one change. You can abandon that and make up your own. But what the CDC tells us, AAP tells us, is that one of the things that works pretty well as far as getting people to immunize their child against HPV is just to normalize it. And the simplest way to do that is when you provide the immunizations, don't say, well, we're going to do the Tdap today, and here's what it is, and here's what it means, and here's what it protects your son against. And then we're going to do the meningococcal vaccine today, and here's what it is, and here's what we do. And then we're going to talk about the HPV. If you spread it out, they all look like they are individual choices. And it's simpler if you just hand it to them as a sandwich. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to immunize your child against Tdap, HPV, and meningococcal vaccines. And stop. There isn't any reason for you to go into any explanation or apology. Just say, this is what we do. When you're immunizing that four-month-old, you know, you don't get into a long conversation about this or that or why we do things. You just say, you know, you came to me as your expert for your child. Here's what I give you as my expert advice. So I would suggest that you just give it a try. And again, immunizing is a team sport, so you need to present it that way. Your MA needs to present it that way. The receptionist needs to present it that way. And then take some data and see if it works. If it fails, you haven't lost much ground because you haven't abandoned, you know, you haven't eroded the trust that you have with your families. If it succeeds, you may have learned something. But I would suggest that it's a simple change. And that's how we learn. We make little simple changes. Now, if when you provide it as a sandwich, they push back, then you go back to your usual mode of explaining what it is and why you do it and why what the data is and, you know, all of the scientific stuff and your motivational intervening. But I would suggest that you try it just as a matter of fact, this is what we do, and see if that works for you. Now, I'm going to try to address the question that was raised. And lawsuits get really tricky because leads to oversimplification on all sides. So let me just talk about all of science is about trying to tease out coincidence from cause and effect. And what we know about the HPV vaccine is we've got 11 years of experience, strongly studied experience. We've got 180 million doses. We've got a lot of data. And what all of that data shows to the scientists that study this at the CDC and is that the vaccine is very safe. It's safer than the Tdap. It's safer than the Menactra. It's safer than the polio vaccine. It is as safe a vaccine as we have. Now, could it cause you know, autoimmune disorders? Could it trigger something in somebody who's genetically kind of prone to overreacting to a vaccine? Certainly it's possible. And how will we know? Well, that data hasn't shown out in the first 180 million cases. So if it is causal, it's obviously at a rate that's less than 2 out of 180 million. So what I tell the parents and what I really do in real life is I say, oh, that's awful. That's got to leave you scared. And when we're scared, it's hard to think through things carefully. So let's talk about what it feels like to be scared and what that means to us. And again, what being fearful means is that something is important, something that's challenging somebody we love. And so then let's try to figure out what's the best choice. Well, there's scary things on both sides. If we don't immunize your child's got an 80% chance of catching these illnesses, contracting these viruses. And your daughter has a 1 in 5 chance of having an abnormal pap smear and a 1 in 150 chance of cervical cancer. And so there's those fears on that side. And on the other side, there's this 1 out of 180 million chance that the vaccine might have caused this unusual occurrence in your cousin. I think it was a cousin. And I mostly say, I can't make this decision for you. But if it was my child, I would choose to protect her from the thing that we know for sure is causal. The HPV infection is likely to happen to her, that is known to cause cancers, versus the other, what might be a coincidence. And then I sort of commiserate with them, that's an awful choice. But that as a parent and as the doctor, we have to face the awful choices. So that's how I do it. It's clumsy. I apologize that I don't have any magic simple thing about it. But that's how I walk my way through the choice.
Does that answer your question? Does anybody want additional clarification on how to approach these difficult topics?
We need to wrap up at this point. And so let me hand it back to Elisa.
Thank you for participating today. And I will be sending out, like I said, a recap email that has a link to the sign-in that has Dr. Liu's tool and Dr. Kepka's resources as well. And also in a day or so, I will have the recorded version that's edited and available for those that weren't able to participate live. Just a reminder that our next call will be on Tuesday, April the 3rd at 8 a.m. And again, we chose that because we do have folks from Alaska. And just a reminder that 8 a.m. in Utah looks like 6 a.m. for Alaska. And so we're doing our best to accommodate all involved in the project. If you have any questions or concerns, please, of course, always let me know. And you will be able to always access the resources on the Utah AAP website under resources under HPV QI 2018 project. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next month.